So that's the sound of me pouring us some coffee so that our brains work for the right dishonourable. That sound's probably going to come across as a lot more lame than
or
I was hoping.
Just someone peeing in a bucket or something.
Well, you've just completely ruined my attempt to use sound effects. Thanks a lot, Jimmy. My name's Jazza.
My name's Jimmy.
Well done. Oh, you're getting the cues now. I'm really proud of you. We are the Right Dishonourable, a podcast where we talk about current events, politics, social issues, and things like that. Neither of us are particularly qualified in any of these spheres, but we like to give you the feel of being down the pub with a pint of IPA, chatting with your mates, and having that go directly into your brain.
Indeed.
So, what are we going to talk about today? Today we're first of all going to...
Yesterday I went down to the anti-austerity march that went from the Bank of England down to Westminster, and we are going to discuss what happened there.
It was hashtag...
End austerity now. Yes.
Which you were misusing for quite a long time, right?
Only a little bit of time.
It's okay, we'll shade on that later. No. Second of all, we're going to talk about the Lib Dem leadership, because we've already used up the Labour leadership, even though that kind of kicked off in earnest. But we're going to talk about Norman Lamb and Tim Farron, who are the two candidates for the Liberal Democrats, and whether their leadership election is significant in any way now that they only have 8 MPs.
And finally, we will be talking about the shooting in Charleston that occurred earlier this week. Basically just discussing race in America, gun control, and just all of the issues that event has provoked.
Correct. So yes, welcome to the Right Dishonourable, and we hope you enjoy this particular episode. So I didn't go to the anti-austerity march yesterday. I went to watch Jurassic World instead. But actually, on my way to the cinema, did come across a kind of like the straggles of it at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And there were lots of people dressed in black and wearing badger outfits and saying that badgers shouldn't be culled. It seemed a bit crap, to be completely honest. Was the main event better than the strags that I saw on the South Bank?
Well, I think a lot of these kind of marches, I mean, what you experienced is the kind of hodgepodge of different groups and interests that actually make up the I guess that you call them socialist rallies that happen every couple of months in London now. They tend to be led by groups such as the People's Assembly, Socialist Workers Party, although I don't think I saw any SWP members there yesterday, the Socialist Party. Also Unite got in on the action yesterday. There's usually various trade unions who turn up, but it is just a random assortment of interests that are all loosely clustered around not liking the Tories.
In that group that I saw, there were a load of posters that said get the Tories out, and I was like, you should have been around a month ago, shouldn't you, really? Like, we're stuck with them for another 5 years.
Well, it's interesting you brought that up, because I was chatting to a couple of people who were down there. I did put the question to them. We've just had an election, and the Tories, for better or worse, did get in. Is what you're doing not somewhat illegitimate in those terms? And the general answer that they gave back, which I think is compelling, is that the electoral system is so messed up, basically, and it's so disproportionate to the way people actually, the result is so disproportionate to the way people actually vote.
It's the most it's the biggest difference between how people voted and the actual seats in parliament ever, or at least in the last 100 years or so.
Yeah, I can believe that. Yeah.
You were talking about it being very much a hodgepodge of lots of different causes, the Badger sympathisers, the Unite people, and various social groups. Do you think that dilutes the reasoning behind it?
Well, one thing that I always end up asking people about these events is, would you not be more effective if you grouped yourselves together?
Mm-hmm.
And the trouble with a lot, I guess, the left in general, or the left outside of groups like parties like the Lib Dems and Labour, is that it's all very Judean People's Front from Monty Python's Life of Brian. It's all these groups that have roughly the same aim, but there's always these falling outs and there's these very trivial disputes. Whoever you talk to almost, there'll be some group who is also marching that they really won't like for one reason or another. Mm. And sometimes I think those reasons are actually legitimate, because there are a fair few unpleasant characters that actually go around these marches. One of them would probably be the group Class War, who are militant is maybe the wrong word, but they often turn up
hardline.
They often turn up in balaclavas and wearing shades and all black, and they look quite threatening.
I think those were the people that we saw.
Yeah,
so they were all in black and were carrying lots of sticks.
Yeah,
but were all kind of like white nerdy people who didn't seem to wash. And I'm probably going to annoy some people with that kind of description. But it's, I feel like, fair. The as somebody who was aware that there was a march happening, but was just ended up being a member of the public who walked past. It all seemed very strange and separate from kind of like the world that was happening on a Saturday afternoon in London. Whereas actually London has a really quite strong history of, recent history of really powerful protests, like the Iraq War and like the student protests that happened in under the last government. Do you think? So I was walking along with my boyfriend, and he was like, "I remember when we had the student protests, and we were actually good at protesting." Do you think that there is that lack of coherency and that lack of a common message and kind of like leadership, perhaps? Do you think that kind of damages the message of anti-austerity, which is a legitimate message that obviously resonates with a lot of people?
Well, I guess I'd refer back to my previous point about the fractioning of different groups and different interests, but there's also a problem. There's certain groups within the left that are opposed to hierarchy, so won't even have a leader. Which I think is
that not... was the Greens for a very
that
long
was the
time.
Greens for a very they used to refer to like their official spokesperson or something similar as opposed to the leader. And there's another group I was chatting to, a guy from Left Unity, who said that there's no particular leader, everyone votes and everything, which very noble but also very inefficient. And it's not there's certain truths about the way that elections work and about the way democracy works, which means that you put yourself at a serious disadvantage if you refuse to play the game in those sort of ways, which I think if your ultimate aim is to, you know, oppose a particular policy or oppose a particular political party, there's maybe some compromises that you should make.
So there were quite a few celebrities in the lineup. So Charlotte Church,
Russell Brand,
who people apparently still remember because she sang P.A. Ozu for the Pope once. Russell Brand,
yes.
Our best friend Owen Jones, and
is Owen Jones a celebrity?
I think he kind of counts as, well, he's got his own internet YouTube channel.
That's
now
a very low bar to have to climb over. To
I mean,
be
screw
a
you. I consider myself a celebrity.
A YouTube celebrity?
No, not really. And also Jeremy Corbyn, who is, although last week we were kind of joking about the fact that he's never going to get on the paper.
He then got on the paper the day after we released the podcast.
Yeah, so everything that we ended up saying was completely irrelevant.
It wasn't irrelevant. He still won't win.
No, he won't win, and he seems really aware that he won't win. But do you think, where were the rest of the leadership candidates? Do you think that it taints the Labour Party to be part of something like this?
Well, actually, John, who writes for the site, John Savanta, who was with me yesterday, pointed out that there were almost no Labour banners anywhere. We actually saw Diane Abbott, who's running for the London mayorship, mayorality. Yeah.
Mayor.
she actually gave a speech fairly early on during the day, and she obviously has a history of aligning herself with these kind of vaguely socialist, social democratic groups on the fringe left. But yeah, aside from her, aside from that one banner we saw from like Colchester Labour Group or whatever,
made the trip down.
Yeah, you know, some obscure branch. Aside from that, there wasn't really any showing. And I guess that probably speaks to the distance between the fringe left and Labour these days.
But then people like Jeremy Corbyn would argue that it's this people who are disaffected and want anti-austerity and want that option on their ballot paper in their local elections that needs to be won over. Would you agree? Are these people who were marching yesterday on Saturday, are they people that are worth winning over?
Well, these people are very politically engaged, but I think their voices are disproportionately loud in the political debate, which a lot of people will probably hear me say that and go, that's ridiculous, we're marginalised by all the mainstream media. Even though I would point out, most of the mainstream media did run something on the protest yesterday.
It was the front page of The Independent on the day after the protest.
Well, there you go. I don't think that there's necessarily a huge amount of votes in this, and I think probably this is just a historic problem with Labour that leads down to the whole Blairite argument. The success of Tony Blair, as far as I can make out, is that he recognised that there was a decline in the working class vote purely for demographic reasons, and there was also just an aspirational quality that
we love the aspirational class.
Yeah, but if there's again, this comes back to certain facts about democracy. You have to play the game. You have to recognise what sort of market you're operating in. I almost don't want to use these kind of crude business terms, but
I mean you kind of have to run a political party these days, right?
Yeah.
In order for you to get that holy 35%. Of the popular vote in order to get a majority in the House of Commons. Is anybody going to give a toss about these protests, or are these just a load of people agreeing with each other in a very small room?
This protest on its own, no one will care, because nobody ever says anything original at these things. It's all largely the same number of people. It's the same celebrities. It's the same politicians as well, the same trade unionists. But if over time the movement does grow and more people turn up at these things,
What was the attendance yesterday, do you know?
The estimates that going into it, I think, were 200,000. I actually don't have any official estimates, but I would certainly believe that there were 100,000 people there. Jazza is now hastily looking this up on the internet.
Keep talking.
But yeah, I think these sort of movements have a long-term future only if they can continue the momentum over the next 5 years, which is probably going to be the course of
Parliament.
The BBC
says tens of thousands.
There were certainly tens of thousands there. I don't know exactly how many.
Neither does the BBC. Nobody was counting in and counting out.
Well, the police will have an official estimate.
I'm sure.
Which will probably be disputed by the organisers for being too small. But yeah, you know, I think it has a future if it can continue the momentum. But I think it's going to be difficult because after all this excitement around the election, eventually people will just start to accept that the government is implementing its programme, and there'll be less coverage, and things will settle down.
Do you think that... So ultimately, the reason for these is to get a certain person in power. Who are these people, these tens of thousands of people, and all of the other ones who are anti-austerity in their viewpoints? Who are these people going to vote for in 2020?
Probably not Labour.
Do you think that it's a fringe party thing? The anti-austerity alliance that we saw in this year's election.
I mean, a lot of people at this thing would be the kind of people who would vote for Jeremy Corbyn as the Labour leader. We've discussed this already. A lot of people think that Andy Burnham will end up as the Labour leader. I don't think will be satisfying as a candidate for a lot of the people that turned up at this anti-austerity thing.
But he is the next best thing, arguably.
That is totally true. But a lot of these people, I think, will... There's such disenchantment with the Labour Party from these groups that they will go down to groups like Left Unity or the Socialist Workers' Party or the Socialist Party. Just these fringe groups that are not very effective at actually implementing the sort of policies that these people want. But, you know... It comes down to that thing of if you don't recognise that there's a significant difference between the Tories and Labour, there's no particular incentive for you to vote Labour.
Cool.
So right now, Tim Farron and Norman Lamb, who are two of the 8 Liberal Democrat MPs that still exist, are touring the country, going to hustings and making their pitches for the leadership of the Liberal Democrat Party following Nick Clegg's resignation at the general election, which we were all very, very sad about.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down to one of these in London to see what they had to say for themselves. And actually, my impression at the moment is that there's not a huge amount of difference between their two platforms. But I think this is still actually, it's still quite an interesting argument purely from the point of view of who will make a more effective leader in terms of communicating the Lib Dems' message and strategizing how they're going to grow their party again from having been destroyed at the election. Me and Jazza have discussed this beforehand, and Jazza has a few opinions about Tim Farron, which I think I'd sort of like to go through before we discuss their platforms any further. So, Jazza.
So, first of all, in an ideal world, neither of these candidates are the perfect person in order to rebuild the Liberal Democrats up from scratch again. I don't think either of them are particularly inspiring. I don't think either of them are particularly good at communicating to people who are anything other than hardcore Liberal Democrat voters. And that in itself is a huge detriment. And also the fact that all of the 8 MPs are white men, like white older men, and that is just, it kind of goes against the whole idea of liberalism, really, like the fact that anybody should have the opportunity to become like party leader or anything.
Tim Farron's a Christian, you know, that's a dying breed within Britain.
Yeah, I'll get onto that.
to go back to the first question, what is your problem particularly with, say, either Tim Farron or Norman Lamb?
So Tim Farron, I particularly have a problem with because of the fact that I feel like he's been very calculated. So this is stuff about his character that I understand isn't particularly important when it comes to politics, but somebody who I think made an active decision to go onto the backbenches of the Liberal Democrats in the run-up to the election because he didn't see them winning, somebody who calculatedly chose to distance himself from what the Liberal Democrats did in government, which actually should be something that we are proud of rather than something that we are ashamed of. I think that that kind of attitude doesn't help, and I think that it kind of like closes the doors to the last 5 years of the Lib Dems, which is the only amount of power that they've really had in the past 100 or so years, and I don't like that kind of calculated thing of, oh, I could have done some difference on the front benches, but instead I decided to position myself really quite well for a leadership election.
See, I feel from the start of the coalition, Farron distanced himself from the government as far as I'm aware, he didn't have a significant ministerial position within the government.
So that's an issue that I have.
Yeah, I mean, he was president at the time, and I suppose maybe you think that you have to maintain a certain distance when you are president, but compared to Norman Lamb, who served as, I'm trying to remember, he was Minister for Mental Health.
Yeah, but he was on the health team.
Yeah, and I think from both of the candidates at the hustings I went to tried to link themselves back to the coalition government, but I think Lamb has the far more plausible link.
Mm-hmm.
He's almost the continuity candidate in the sense that he's the more natural successor to Nick Clegg.
One of the other things that I have a problem with Tim Farron is obviously the gay marriage thing.
Yeah.
And I feel like now he's trying to explain it away, but also, like, I've heard this kind of argument from a lot of conservative MPs who, oh yeah, I was voting for my constituents. I have changed my mind since, and I just have to call bullshit. because when it was convenient for you to vote no, you decided to vote no, and now that all of a sudden your opinions are in the public eye, you have to kind of pivot to having a more popular opinion, and that really annoys me. Especially it's very salient for me because it's my rights, right?
Yes. But actually, Tim Farron, as I understand it, has also been reluctant to vote on in favour of issues such as abortion, so sort of allowing more easy access to abortion and that.
Yeah,
sort
and
of
I
thing.
Think those kinds of stances that he has, probably because of his Christian background, it's going to make us sound quite anti-Christian. But I think that is problematic in a country that is majority secular, and that does believe in abortion rights, and that does believe in marriage equality for LGBT people. And I think that isn't going to help the Liberal Democrats particularly grow a base. And the Lib Dems have traditionally been a socially liberal party, and that's been kind of like their defining thing. What happens when they have a more socially conservative leader?
To be fair to Farron, I've heard him talk in the past about disestablishing the church, so actually severing the link between the church and the state. And I mean, I don't think the gay marriage thing is not good. Neither really is his stance on abortion. None of these things are good. I'm not sure he's really socially conservative. I mean, he might be personally, but politically speaking, I feel that there is actually some gap between the way he would conduct his personal life and also the way that he would actually want the country to be set up in terms of what you're allowed to do. The other thing, I mean, you've mentioned the white male thing, but he's actually somebody who came from a poor background, which in sort of Westminster leadership terms is, you know, that
it's a defining characteristic, right?
It is. And also what I think from a kind of pragmatic media point of view, I think he speaks so much better than Lamb does. There's something.
So that's the thing, I'm really aware of the fact that Tim Farron is a much better communicator, and that's what you need.
Yes.
And you look at like the Labour Party, and I think the biggest problem with the Labour Party wasn't policy, wasn't Ed Miliband, it was lack of communication and ability to communicate the Labour message that lost them the election.
Do you think that's a problem with Farron? Do you think there's a danger he could be smeared in similar ways?
Like I said, I think that Farron, out of Farron and Lamb, is clearly the better communicator.
Sure.
And performs better on stuff like Question Time, which is really important.
Yes.
And probably in the grand scheme of things, and he is probably going to be the next leader, let's make no bones about it.
Well, the indications are that the grassroots prefer Farron to Lamb. We should probably talk a little bit more about Lamb, because I feel we're giving it slightly short shrift.
I feel like Lamb is really good at the stuff that he's good at, but then there's so many black holes in kind of like his opinions, and also his lack of communication skills is a problem.
Well, he's not that bad a communicator. I don't want to sort of overemphasize it. It's just that compared,
he's not going to inspire anyone, I don't.
Yeah, he's got quite a plodding sort of voice, whereas
which is quite cute.
Well, Farron has like the gift of the rhetoric, and he can sort of conjure up things, and it sounds good, but. As you say, what I found at the hustings was that Lamb was good on stuff like mental health and pupil premiums, so getting kids into schools and getting more money to education. But there seemed to be a lack of a coherent kind of message, whereas Farron was very clearly angling towards the social democratic inequality side of the message, kind of as an inheritor of the Charles Kennedy tradition, basically.
So we are going to have a EU referendum in the next couple of years. And traditionally the Lib Dems have kind of painted themselves as the party of in. I think it is actually how they painted themselves in the run-up.
The Lib Dems are a purely Europhile party.
Pretty
basically.
Much, yeah. So do you think that either of these potential leaders are going to be able to play a particularly significant role in the European referendum debate?
See, I would have said that Clegg was actually far better positioned to do that.
He didn't do very well when he debated Farage, though, did he?
That is true, but Clegg has... He lived in Brussels for a couple of years. I think he worked with the EU Commission.
He was an MEP as well.
There you go. And he has a background in Europe. He's married to a Spaniard, is that correct? So he's actually a genuine European citizen in that sense.
He's fluent in like seven languages.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of that
one. But as you say, he's not actually that credible a figure with the public, particularly because of the tuition fees thing.
But do you think that Lamb and... So this is obviously something that Clegg was particularly passionate about.
Yes.
In terms of making sure that there was a pro-European case. Mm. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I've not yet heard either Farron or Lamb really be incredibly pro-European and be like, we are the party of in, we should be fighting the EU referendum like very strongly, either as part of a wider pan-party campaign or as on our own. Do you think that this mantle that Clegg kind of took up as the pro-European party could kind of be diminished under either Tim Farron or Norman Lamb?
Well, as far as the hustings go, I'm not sure the EU as a topic is a kind of growth area for the Lib Dems. Even though it's very important, the arguments around it are very technocratic, and it's just quite complicated and legalistic in a lot of ways. So I'm not sure that there's much incentive for either candidate to go on about the EU, even though I think a lot of the potential liberals out there are probably broadly in favour of the EU.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably not the most important thing to them, I don't think. I think probably the most important thing for the Lib Dems is probably around civil liberties, Snooper's Charter, Human Rights Act, and that sort. Which, admittedly, the Human Rights Act is linked to
drugs reform.
Drugs reform. But yeah, as far as I can remember, at the hustings, neither of them said anything significant about the EU, which is telling.
Which actually depresses me a little bit. Let us know what you guys think of the two Liberal Democrat leaders. We are on Twitter as @RightDishonour.
Yes.
And you can also go onto our website, which is rightdishonourable.com, and have a butcher's at the kind of stuff that is being put up there. I posted an article last week.
He did, genuinely.
And it wasn't shit. You only changed some things in it.
It wasn't too bad in terms of editing, which is nice.
So go and check out our content on the website.
So Jazz's piece is on the Labour leadership.
Yeah.
I actually have a piece on the Lib Dem leadership as well.
Yeah.
So which covers most of the stuff that we covered in this, so you can go and read
those. Those are the only two parties that are now changing leaders at the moment, right?
Surely this.
We're not starting
surely the Greens will, you know, think about it soon. Follow us on Twitter?
Thanks. The obligatory Natalie Bennett shout-out. Thank you for following us on Twitter, Natalie. It would be nice if you left us a review on iTunes. Thanks, Nat.
So last week, a man walked into a church in Charleston in South Carolina and shot... Is it nine people within that church?
Also just sat in a Bible study class for an hour before he opened fire.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of weird things about this story that we will get into. But the man is 21-year-old Dylan Roof, or is allegedly 21-year-old Dylan Roof. They have CCTV images of him entering the church. He's been arrested in North Carolina and... I believe extradited back into South Carolina, where they have the death penalty for offences of this sort. So the story obviously made international headlines in line with America's historic and ongoing problem with racism and also with gun crime. So, I mean, Jazza, you've sort of been following these sort of stories for the past couple of years. You followed the Sandy Hook story. Is there anything significant about this particular incident?
No, frankly. I feel like the race element of it is like a particular kind of... It makes it very timely in terms of like race relations in the US right now. But otherwise, it's another like... Frankly, speaking as if we're talking at a pub, it's another nutter with a gun who's gone in and decided that he wants to shoot some people.
Mm.
And the reason that he's able to get his hands on a gun is because of lax gun control laws in the USA. And when you watch American media coverage and you compare it to what it was like with the Sandy Hook coverage, it's exactly the same.
Mm.
So it's the Foxes being very, very defensive and being... like, well, this is because there's a crazy person. This is not because of the fact that there are guns.
Yes.
And then the left just... And the left... Well, like, the more moderate media of CNN and MSNBC just being like, why are we not able to control guns? And what was really telling is the response of the president, which, after Sandy Hook, was very optimistic and very much like... We can do this, 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 and this. And most people agree with background checks for people to be able to own firearms. And most people agree that people with mental health issues shouldn't have firearms, etc., etc., etc. And there was hope there. And you watch the president talk about the Charleston killings, and it just seems like... He's just like, yeah, but I can't do anything about it because Congress is against me, because the House is against me, and because quite a lot of the right-wing media is against... Well, all of the right-wing media is against me. And it's very depressing that these things are inevitably going to keep on happening. That gun control, I think, I clearly have opinions on this. Gun control is clearly the answer.
Do you not think it's difficult in a country such as the States that has a gun culture in terms of people actually using guns for sport and people being feeling very attached to guns, but also it has, I think it's a country of 300 million people, and I think I read around the time of the Sandy Hook incident, which was last year, I think, but it's...
Sandy Hook was 2 years ago.
Was it 2 years ago? But there's apparently 200 million guns in the States, so that's, you know, two for every three citizens. Mm-hmm. Is it even possible to deal with, you know, to deal with something like that when there are actually so many guns? Even if you banned guns tomorrow, would it...
So what's used as an example, as like a case study for how to deal with these kind of things is Australia.
Okay.
Which used to have incredibly lax gun laws, very similar to what the US has now. Basically anybody could have a gun. They also have a frontier culture. They also very much had a, like, everybody owns a gun and you're in the outback and you have to shoot snakes. Specifically snakes, for reason was the thing that came into my head. And they had a massacre in the mid-90s and introduced universal background checks for people to be able to own a firearm. So suicides plummeted, first of all, and as did, like, homicides with guns, like, just dropped. Like, there was huge uproar. People weren't like, oh yeah, this is the answer in Australia. People weren't, like, on board for this, but the government made an executive decision to start controlling guns in a more like a more strict way.
Is that a legitimate course of action in a democratic country, where the government actually overrides the feelings of its
citizens? So this is often used as the anti-control guns argument in the US. It's extreme. And what's the law that when you start mentioning Hitler, then you've lost the argument?
Godwin's law.
So Godwin's law comes into effect very rapidly when you start talking about gun laws, because Hitler introduced gun control in Nazi Germany, and that is very often used as like the, oh, therefore we could have a Hitler in the USA, and I that's kind of like justification. What I think is a more interesting thing is the fact that most American gun users are the kind of gun users that I grew up around. I'm a country boy in the UK. I was around people who used to go fox hunting. We used to go pheasant shooting. I'm a lot posher than probably I let on. And I think that my experience with guns is probably very similar to a lot of the people who are pro-gun in the US, in terms of them being people who are like country-based people, rather than those who are... Like, the majority of gun crime are not these massacres that's, like, crime in big cities. Yeah. But these kinds of massacres are particularly horrific because you feel like nowhere is safe, and they often happen in remote areas like Sandy Hook and Lake Charleston. And the thing is, people like me do support... Like, when you look at polling, people like me in the US do support background checks.
Sure.
Like, something like 80%+ of Americans in general support background checks for everybody who wants to buy a gun. The problem is lobbying and the amount of money behind behind right-wing media.
So the problem,
and fear,
to be explicit about it, is the National Rifle Association.
Not just them, but yes, like the amount of money that is behind people who are invested in selling lots of guns, and Americans owning multiple guns.
So do you agree with Obama's analysis, which is that this problem will continue for the next, indefinitely, basically?
Yeah.
And do you...
I think until they bring in more strict gun control laws, these things will continue happening. And it blows my mind that you have, like, one of these... You have this kind of style of shooting, of massacre, like, every couple of years in the US.
Well, several times a year.
Yeah, sure. Like, several times a year, actually. But in terms of, like, big international ones that come to our attention. And it's like, and from hello to all of the Americans listening, the rest of the world is perplexed. Like, we just don't get what kind of idea of, like, frontier and being able to protect yourself from the man or whatever can justify children and innocent people losing their lives in such a flippant way. And then every time the US just goes like, oh, yeah, we should probably control guns a bit more.
Should,
and then
should point out
happens.
That there's I think maybe 8 different states that have actually introduced tighter background checks around the purchasing of guns, but nothing's happened at federal level because, as you say,
I think that nothing is going to really happen until it's tackled on a federal level.
So if to sort of move the conversation,
I'll calm down.
I'm not worried if you're not being calm, but to the other element of this. To what extent is this actually indicative of America's racist problem?
So I think that these are two separate issues that have happened to collide at an incredibly important time for one of these issues, which is the
race thing,
the issue of race in the USA. And it's collided with an older problem that the US has had.
Mm.
And I don't think that it's particularly. Like, other people may have other opinions, and feel free to argue with us at Right Dishonor on Twitter.
Just to add some background before you go into this, Roof is a white guy. I think all the people he killed were black.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's been photos found on the internet of him holding variously the Confederate flag, yeah. Which is a symbol that's widely regarded as racist in parts of the US.
I mean, it's a symbol that's regarded as widely racist, but there's like 3 states that maintain the Confederate flag or part of the Confederate flag as its state flag.
Yes.
And like that also kind of blows my mind, right? That there's so clearly a gap between how like race relations have moved on in the past, like they have a black president, for example.
Yes.
But then there's still these pockets and parts of the US that are so tied to race politics in a negative way. That just kind of, like, it's such a big and complicated problem. And then you bring the police into it, and you bring, like, hate crimes like Charleston into it.
Yes.
And it just kind of, like, I wouldn't want to be in charge of anything in the US right now, because I'd be scared of stepping on something.
Mm.
I wanted also to talk about media coverage of Roof, of Dylan Roof specifically.
Sure, yeah.
So I have a huge issue with there being any naming or like image representation of these killers in the mainstream media, or in any media, quite frankly.
I think that the worst example that we found between us was,
oh, Jesus,
was
yeah.
The Guardian, I think the day after the shooting or whatever, ran a headline, and it was a big picture of Dylan wearing the black jacket that had flags from Rhodesia, which is the country that is now called Zimbabwe, which was ruled by the white minority before the name change and the regime change, and also apartheid South Africa. Mm. So obviously you can sort of see where his political leanings are. But the headline that accompanied it was something to the effect of, look into the eyes of a racist killer, or presumably alleged racist killer. I'm not even sure they use that word. But how do you feel about that kind of imagery then?
like just appalled, because you have a certain amount of social responsibility as a media organisation, and especially from The Guardian, which is meant to be like it's quite self-righteous every now and again, but is meant to kind of like take its news seriously and have social responsibility.
Yes.
And that was not a socially responsible headline or a socially responsible kind of like clickbait. Like we know that violence begets violence, and that the more you have kind of these people held up in the public eye, and not like held up but kind of like presented in the public eye, that gives people reason to think, oh god, if I do this I can become like widely talked about. And very often with people who are mentally unstable, that's all they bloody need. And there's so many studies around this that prove that like not naming killers, not having the faces of killers in the media means that there are less kind of like mimic crimes and
copycat crimes. Yeah.
It just baffles me that media organisations that have this amount of power continue to be incredibly irresponsible with the way that they report on these stories. And it makes me really fucking angry, frankly.
I mean, that obviously won't change in the American media climate, given the competitiveness and the sensationalness, well, the sensationalist aspect of it. But do you see that as likely to change in the UK or the way we cover things?
I think because these aren't in our backyard, no. Right. I feel like The Guardian, with that kind of a headline, is directly trying to compete with American audiences, because those are the people that are mainly going to be searching for this story. And
I mean,
it's worth
bearing in mind that the Guardian website has a huge American audience.
Massive
now.
American audience.
I want to say that it's actually the US audience is bigger than the UK audience, but I could be incorrect. It's certainly very substantial.
They have a large US audience. So I think that's probably why they went for such an extreme article, because the editorial decision was made in New York.
It may be that the headline on the website was actually different from the headline on the print.
Yeah,
so
I wouldn't
swear by that. But any final thoughts on this?
I'll sort it out, US.
I think we'll leave it there.
Yeah. Okay, we should probably say goodbye as well, because
we probably
this is our
should.
Last topic. And sorry for ending on a downer on our second actual podcast. Please, if you are listening, rate us however many stars you want. If you think we're shit, just give us a rating anyway. And leave us like a short line in review, because that really helps us out. It gets more people to actually listen to the podcast, which is really cool.
And also, if you have any, you know, genuine criticism or comments, suggestions of anything that we've done, either be it on the site or on the podcast, then actually get in touch as well, which you can do through, as we said earlier, Twitter, there's comments on the website. This will probably go up on YouTube, so there'll be comments there, or just send us an email.
Yeah. I have been Jazza.
I have been Jimmy.
And this has been The Right Dishonourable. Thank you very much. Goodbye.